Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 20th of February. It is President's Day, a perfect day on all things political to speak with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who wrote a very interesting article about the current president's visit to Milwaukee last Wednesday. We will talk about that. We'll talk about Rick Santorum. He's all over the news. And look at whether or not social issues are of great concern and will play a larger role in this presidential election than we thought they would when the news was all about the economy. The question is the race still all about the economy, or is it about social issues as well? Craig is Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd care to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Craig.
Good morning.
Happy President's Day.
Happy President's Day to you.
Who do you find endlessly fascinating among the presidents?
Who?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the usual, you know, I think Lincoln tops almost everybody's list. I am kind of a Lincolnophile. I mean, I've read a lot of books about Lincoln. I mean, what fascinates me about him, among other things, is that he's a rare politician who is also a brilliant writer. You could think of, you know, kind of successful writers who were also politicians as a pretty short list. Maybe, you know, Winston Churchill and Teddy Roosevelt. There are not too many, you know, without going back to the ancient times. So Lincoln was, Ulysses Grant wrote a brilliant memoir, too. But Lincoln was just kind of uniquely gifted as a communicator, along with being this pivotal and kind of seductive historical figure.
Yeah, I'm with you. I would agree. I haven't read Grant's memoir. It came up, we did a Grant's Last Year in Life a couple weeks ago, somebody who wrote about Grant, saying that he has been rather underrated, and 100 years from now we're going to say that Ulysses Grant was a heck of a president.
Well, I don't know if, I mean, I think he's, I don't know if anybody would make the case he was a great president, but the people will be, are making the case that he was not as, certainly not the horrible president that he's been made out to be by history. And, you know, there were some scandals. The thing about his memoirs is that they're so well written, and it's such a kind of distinctive but sort of simple voice that that there's kind of a the historical equivalent of an urban myth that Mark Twain actually wrote them, because the two were close, and Mark Twain was kind of an editor to the memoirs, but there's no evidence he actually wrote them. But that's how good they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad I asked you that question.
You touched on a subject close to my heart.
I guess I did. I may return to it sometime during the hour. The current president was in Milwaukee last week, and you wrote a good article about his trip to this city. And let's look at, you write that no other battleground state has lost private sector jobs for 6 months now in a row, and it's a concern for both Obama and also for Scott Walker.
Yeah, I mean, a bigger concern for Scott Walker in the sense that this is going against the grain of the national trend. So if the national trend continues to be an improvement in the jobs picture, then obviously that's good for President Obama. In Scott Walker's case, he did run on a platform of increasing, very specific promise or goal of increasing 250,000 jobs in the state of Wisconsin, and he's obviously not on a pace to do that. And there's, you know, all sorts of debates you can have about why that's happened, but and what's going on in Wisconsin, which is kind of fascinating, because we are going against the grain of the national trend, and for one reason, for whatever reason, we've actually been losing private sector jobs instead of gaining them since about the middle of last year. So I think we sometimes lose sight in the midst of the recall fight and all the, you know, kind of real political debates and battles going on in Wisconsin that you know, there's this fundamental driver of elections, which is the economy, and most people who study this will say that it's not the unemployment rate itself, but it's the trend. And so whatever the trend is going into an election year and in an election year, if it's positive, that's obviously helpful to incumbents, and if it's negative, it isn't.
The governor has said, and you quote him, saying, if we suddenly awaken this wave of people who will come out and vote for me, I think those people are likely to vote for Republicans in the fall.
Well, these elections are a few months apart, and what he was really talking about was something that some Republicans felt happened in the legislative recalls last summer, which is that there was a point in time when they thought they were going to lose more than two seats, and clearly the recalls mobilized Democrats, but that they felt that at a certain point their base was energized and mobilized in reaction to the recalls and a reaction to the Democrats. And so he's making the argument or the suggestion that there's something similar could happen in his recall fight, that his base will be mobilized just as much as the Democratic base. In fact, he's sort of arguing that Democrats are already mobilized. I mean, look at the recall petition drive. And so they're not going to get that much. Again, this is his argument. They're not going to get that much more bounce out of being energized in a recall election because they're already there, and yet Republicans could be some Republicans could be woken up by this and could be driven to vote. Now, in terms of its impact on the presidential race, it's kind of another story because obviously the presidential race has turned people out more than any other kind of election. I mean, however high the turnout is going to be in this gubernatorial recall, I can't imagine it being higher than a presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the nature of these elections. That would be pretty extraordinary. So I'm not sure that the recall is going to make people vote in the presidential election. It will be organizationally important because it gives both parties a chance to kind of test drive their get-out-the-vote operations. And in the case of the Democrats, they have this extra bonus of having a million names to work with from the people that signed the recall petitions.
When is this recall election likely to be, Craig?
Well, a lot of people are betting June, but there's a lot of moving parts here that make it hard to predict with certainty. I mean, there's an expectation now there'll be a Democratic primary among the many uncertainties as to who the Democratic nominee is going to be. But there could be a Democratic primary in May and a general election in June. There's, you know, things could delay that if the this phase where we're looking at the recall petitions, if that's drawn out either by legal battles or just the process that the Government Accountability Board decides it needs more time, challenges back and forth. But I think the betting is kind of on June at the moment.
May for a primary doesn't give the Democrats very much time to do campaigning here. Are they putting themselves in a bad situation by not rallying early around somebody?
Well, yeah, I think ideally, there's a couple different ways to look at this. I think it's not an ideal picture for the Democrats in terms of, you know, they're divided over. And the interest groups are divided, the unions are divided over who their nominee should be, with other constituencies in the Democratic Party. Some of the biggest names have declined to run, you know, Russ Feingold among them. So there is concern among Democrats about who their nominee is going to be and whether their nominee is going to be good enough to beat Walker. So that's a real issue. But that was the nature of this process. It wasn't... They embarked on the recall process without knowing who they were going to run against Scott Walker. That was just the way it worked out. And so, so now we have an election, and now they have to figure out, the Democrats have to figure out who they're going to run against Walker. It does obviously matter who they're going to run against Walker, in part because it matters in any election, but this is not going to be an up or down vote on the governor. This is going to be a regular election ballot hitting the governor against a Democrat. The only good thing about not having a candidate from the Democratic perspective is that all that money that Scott Walker has raised and also that some of outside groups will spend can't be used yet against the Democratic nominee because we don't know who that nominee is going to be.
Right. Do you think that Mayor Barrett will enter the race?
I don't know. I certainly wouldn't be surprised if he does. He's been he's been very noncommittal about it. I mean, he certainly sent some signals, back channel signals that he wants to do it or that he's kind of heading there. But, you know, I think when I talk to Democrats in the state, they're really not sure. And so if he does run, he's certainly got a good chance of being the nominee. But you don't know. I mean, there'll be a primary and there are, you know, some of the public sector unions don't favor him. They favor Kathleen Falk, and mm-hmm. So that's another wild card in a Democratic primary.
And is there another possible candidate who is a wild card who might do very well?
Well, I guess in theory, yes, but we don't know. I mean, I've asked that question a lot, and again, you know, Russ Feingold clearly is not going to run. I talked to him again last week. You know, Herb Kohl is somebody that people, some people have approached in the party to run as kind of like a, you know, an elder statesman, to be kind of a caretaker governor for 2 years and heal the state, quote unquote. He's, you know, hasn't shown a lot of interest in doing that. I mean, he just, you know, announced his retirement last year to the Senate. And so if you're ready to retire from the Senate, it's hard to imagine you wanting to be governor, which is a much more really pressure-packed job than being one of 100 senators is. So, you know, the nature of these wild card scenarios is that we don't know what they are until they happen. But
right.
But I don't know. I don't know if I can't give you a good scenario for it being a surprise candidate.
Well, it's all going to happen pretty darn soon, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the election will happen very quickly, which, and it'll seem kind of quick and sudden. On the other hand, the run up to this has been so long, and whenever you're talking about the recall election, and it will be driven. Even though it matters who the Democratic nominee is, it will be driven so much by people's attitudes toward the incumbent governor, Scott Walker, and so many people are locked in, for better or for worse, pro and con on Scott Walker, that a lot of this is kind of baked in the cake. I mean, that there's some giant percentage of the electorate that, that is probably can't be moved on this question. And so it really is one of these, going to be one of these elections where there's going to be some smallish subset of voters who could be, you know, who could themselves be all over the map about Scott Walker, but are having to decide whether they want to recall him or not.
Right. Where is the John Doe probe right now? Has the governor met with the investigators? Do we know this?
I don't know if he's met with them. I mean, we know that he was going to meet with them. And I don't think it's been reported that he's met with them, but it's a mysterious and open-ended thing, and it's obviously a cause of concern among many Republicans because it presents so much uncertainty, and because it kind of has gotten at people around the governor and. It's just not known how close to the governor it's going to get, whether it will be, how damaging or potentially damaging it could be to the governor. I mean, it's a huge, among many wild cards, it's a huge one in this whole process. But it's a unique one because it's not, it's following its own dynamic and its own process because it's a criminal investigation. So it's proceeding really on its own clock. And in ways that really can't be predicted.
So those people who are doing the investigation are not thinking, oh, we got to get this going pretty quickly because there's going to be a recall election. It might be this summer. We need to finish our work before this summer.
That wouldn't be in the job description to be thinking that way.
Rick Santorum, let's move to national politics. We, of course, are going to welcome phone calls in just a moment. This guy's popularity just keeps going up. He might win Michigan. What's going on?
Well, the first thing that's going on, which has been talked about a lot in this cycle, is that you know, Mitt Romney's weakness as the early on and presumed front runner has created a vacuum. And right now, Rick Santorum is filling that vacuum. But it's all part of a pattern, a crazy pattern in this race of people arising and falling and coming back from the dead. And now you've got Rick Santorum with, you know, having come out of nowhere to win Iowa and then collapsing in New Hampshire and South Carolina and not doing much in Florida, then coming out of nowhere to win some caucus states and now surging in the national polls. You know, but that's not unique to Rick Santorum. I mean, we've seen that with Newt Gingrich, who now seems to be dead again, but for the third time. He's risen twice from near-death experiences already. So it's been kind of a unique Republican presidential race, but I think what is really at work, the fundamentals, are that you've got this kind of restive Republican electorate that really wants to beat Barack Obama, that's kind of, you know, feeding that is, you know, has a lot of kind of conservative grassroots potential energy out there and a demand for a candidate that both is electable but is also sufficiently conservative and resonates with that base, and there hasn't been one. And now Rick Santorum, you know, is resonating to some degree with some of those voters, but you don't know how much of that is Rick Santorum and how much of it is just filling a vacuum created by the other candidates. And so, you know, Rick Santorum, like, you know, if Rick Santorum were a perfect candidate, you know, he'd already be the front runner. But he's been running for a long, long time. But the pattern has been, as soon as with each one of these guys, as soon as they rise, you know, the scrutiny increases, the attacks increase, and then they wilt again. So Rick Santorum, you know, is a mixed bag, and he's an interesting guy. I followed him on the campaign trail in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. You know, I guess to his credit, you could say that he doesn't pull his punches when it comes to the issues that he really cares about. And there's two sets of issues that he is just absolutely ardent on, and one is kind of the social issues, his religious faith, and how that informs his views on cultural issues. He's probably, you know, he might have been the most conservative Republican on many social issues in the United States Senate when he served. And then the other set of issues is foreign policy. He's very hawkish, mm-hmm. and he's very interventionist, and you know, both those things are potential lightning rods for him, not only in the Republican primary process, but if he were to be the nominee in a general election.
He's gotten himself in a bit of hot water by talking about President Obama's policies not being based on the Bible, policies based on some phony theology. Would he be best advised to stay away from that kind of rhetoric?
Yeah, but I don't think he can help himself. And you know, the great example of this was New Hampshire. Now, he was never going to do very well in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is not exactly representative of the United States as a whole, but New Hampshire is a place where even conservatives and even religious conservatives don't really believe in having a kind of in politics being about religion, and they don't believe in kind of having an explicit discussion about all this stuff. They just don't think that's what politics is. So when Rick Santorum showed up in New Hampshire, and he did all these town meetings, again, to his credit, and answered questions and didn't pull his punches, It went over like a lead balloon, because people, he was just tonally out of sync with those kind of more libertarian, old-fashioned New England voters. And so the question is, to what degree that's a problem with the broader electorate. And but he just, what he showed me in New Hampshire was that he just wasn't a guy who was going to tailor his message that way. Even perhaps knowing that it wasn't the right message for that crowd.
Mm-hmm. Craig Gilbert is our guest for All Things Political this President's Day, and we go to your phone calls. Here is our number, and I'll give you the email as well. The phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We welcome your phone calls, and we have lines open for you at this very moment, so grab one. And if you want to say who your favorite president was, we'll allow that. It, after all, is President's Day. Ms. Nancy Pearl is with us the second hour of our show today. Librarian extraordinaire, get your pens and papers ready, because she will give us book recommendations. And I would imagine some of them might be books about presidents. She's done that before, and they've been very good suggestions. To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, is our guest for All Things Political. And we go to your phone calls. We've been talking about the Republican presidential race and the president's visit to Milwaukee. Certainly a recall looks like it is quite possible and probable in the state of Wisconsin, what it means for the Republicans, what it means for the Democrats, who you would like to see run as a Democratic opponent to the governor, the amount of money coming into this race, into this state. We will talk more about that with Craig as we continue. We start our calls with Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. Happy President's Day.
Thanks. You too.
I guess my two favorite presidents would be Lincoln and Roosevelt, because they both, you know, were presidents during maybe the most troubling periods in our country's history, and were great leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I like that Lincoln said was, "A house divided cannot stand," which I think that's what's going on, obviously in Wisconsin and in our country today. And I think that these social issues that Rick Santorum, like, it's frustrating because the government doesn't require anyone to use contraceptives. So these people get up in arms about that, but if you don't want to use them, then don't use them. And if you want to pray, then pray. No one can keep someone from praying. It's unless they take control of your brain, how can they stop someone from praying? It's just a very divisive issue, and the message of Jesus Christ is love and compassion. And when I listen to Rush Limbaugh, you know, I have to say, where is the love?
Craig.
Well, you know, what's interesting about this kind of resurgence into the, at least the media debate in recent weeks of social issues, particularly the contraception issue, is it's kind of, there are people on both sides that are kind of convinced it's a winner for them. And particularly the contraception issue, you've got people on the right arguing that this is going to hurt President Obama with Catholic voters or more conservative Catholic voters. And then you've got people on the left thinking that any discussion of contraception in which Republicans are the people appearing to be opposed to contraception, which, again, there is not the position they're necessarily taking, but they're convinced that, you know, that social issues, particularly in this environment where economics is driving the election, is a loser for the Republican Party. And certainly when you look at Santorum and his, over the weekend, you know, all the interviews he did, and his inability to kind of get off that topic and is potentially, you know, a problem for him. So it's going to be fascinating to see which side is right and how this stuff cuts in the end. I mean, it could be that it all fades by the time the election comes around. Most people have seen this election as one that's, again, driven by the economy, but you never know. And so we've had this kind of almost quasi return, again, at least in the media side of the campaign, to the culture wars of past years. And it's there. I mean, the divisions are there. Obviously, they're real. I mean, this is a polarized country, and then part of the reason for that polarization are these sets of hot-button issues that really divide people.
Except the issue of contraception seems to be a losing one to me. People use contraception. It's not something that seems that we ought to be debating in the year 2012, even those who are Catholics are using contraception.
That's a classic case of kind of how you frame the issue determines how it plays. And so if you frame the issue that way, yeah. But people on the conservative side of this debate would frame it as an issue of kind of religious freedom and the government trying to tell people what to do and to do things that are contrary to their faith. So it really depends on how you frame the issue.
Right. And let's spend a few moments talking about Willem's concern about the House divided. By golly, it is so incredibly divided. You've covered politics for a long time. I can't imagine that you've seen a time, Craig, when it was as divided as it is now. It's just kind of poisonous, isn't it?
Yeah, although it is good to keep these things in perspective. I was just reading a really good biography of Clarence Darrow written by a journalist here in Washington named Jack Farrell. It came out this year. And it takes you back to the turn of the century when we think about the labor wars of today and how kind of bitter they are. I mean, back then, people were killing governors. The LA Times building was blown up. There were massacres on both sides around strikes and scabs and union workers. I mean, there was kind of ongoing, almost routine violence and physical strife associated with, among other things, the fight over labor and over unions. So it's good to keep these things in perspective. Certainly in our frame of reference, which is more contemporary, it stands out. And you kind of run out of hyperbole and run out of superlatives to talk about how polarized and how divided and how bitter some of this is. And, you know, it is the world we live in. It's not all as a result of what's happened, even in Wisconsin. It's not entirely as a result of what's happened since Scott Walker took office and the fight over his proposals, we did. I think we can all remember. I certainly remember in 2004 in the Bush-Kerry race, the feeling on the ground of just real animosity, real incivility, real intense division around that race. It manifested itself in all sorts of ways, but it's kind of on another level now, and particularly in Wisconsin, it's really acute. And so I think everybody agrees it's sort of nasty and unfortunate. But you know, it doesn't. You'll never get people to agree on whose fault it is and why it's happening.
Please give us the author again of the Clarence Darrow book.
His name is John Aloysius Ferrell.
Okay. We're going to have to do a show with him.
Yeah, it's a good, and there's some Wisconsin stuff in there, too.
Oh.
There was a big strike in Oshkosh that's covered pretty closely in the book. Darrow being a Chicago figure, he had some kind of Wisconsin associations. But it's just a fascinating kind of slice of history.
All right. Thanks, Willem, for your call. Bill in Windsor. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Bill.
My favorite president would probably be Thomas Jefferson.
And because?
I love his intellect, his leadership, and probably my favorite book that really defines him is Undaunted Courage. And the issue that I'm concerned with is I do favor Kathleen Fox. Why don't you run for governor? as my candidate, but I'm really troubled about signing pledges to do or not do something. I know the Republicans, almost all of the Senate and the Congress have signed pledges with Grover Norquist not to raise taxes. I really find that offensive and almost unconstitutional. And then to see that Kathleen Falk has signed the pledge with the unions to rescind the collective bargaining agreement. I almost take that as a given. And signing pledges, to me, identifies a vested interest and a loyalty that should not be there.
Thanks, Bill, for your comments. Craig?
And Undaunted Courage was the book about Lewis and Clark, right? I don't know if he's still on.
Oh, was it? Is it? Undaunted Courage is about Lewis and Clark, Bill?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
okay.
That was a great book.
Oh.
You know, I don't know if she literally signed a pledge. I could be wrong. I'm not sure whether she signed a pledge or just made a commitment, a verbal commitment or what. But you know, it's a legitimate question. I mean, there's been a lot of debate around pledges, as he mentioned, with the famous no tax pledge that Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform has popularized among Republicans. So it's kind of symptomatic, I guess, of how locked in both sides get and the inability to find common ground. Obviously, if you've got people making the degree to which you've got people making ironclad promises and commitments to strong constituencies in their parties on the right and the left, limits the maneuvering ground of, you know, limits the potential for any deal making, obviously, and limits the potential for finding common ground. Now, on an issue like collective bargaining, there may not be common ground to be had, so it's really kind of more like a war, and more like a, you know, we've got to beat the other side, we're not going to find an agreement with them. But more broadly, I mean, a lot of the political disagreements we have are taking on those dimensions. I mean, you hear Republicans saying, you know, Obama isn't somebody we can compromise with, we just have to beat him. And looking at the 2012 election, people on both sides looking at the 2012 election as, you know, looking to the voters and saying, hey, look, you know, throwing up their hands and saying, we can't agree with these other guys, you're just going to have to decide it for us, voters. So that's kind of, it's, and I don't know if the voters are really want to do that or in a position to settle this great, you know, kind of, these great ideological clashes, whether they're interested in kind of picking sides for now and forever in that fight. But it's almost gotten to the point where that's, you know, there's no other way to advance the ball.
And as long as our side conversation is on presidents, this President's Day, both of you would enjoy, if you haven't read it, Nancy Pearl is our guest next hour, and she told me about it, and then we interviewed the author, and I've told everybody about it, and everybody, including my dentist, my husband, my friends who have read it, loved it, is about James Garfield, Destiny of the Republic, Candace Millard. You would both love the book.
Wow.
Because who knows about James Garfield? But by all accounts, it's too bad he didn't live, because he would have been great. So that's just my recommendation. Bill, thank you very much for your call. James in Janesville. Hi.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just, I'm an independent who thinks, you know, the people on both sides of the aisle are a lot closer than most people realize. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. Seems like the Republicans and Democrats want to use the government as a tool to, you know, protect people from themselves and from their neighbor and from the payday loan guy. And Santorum wants to get on there and legislate morality. You know, we need school prayer and outlaw abortion. Well, I just wanted to tell him, you know, most of the heavyweight movements from the people from the temperance movement said at the end, you know, the government just cannot legislate morality. You know, it seems like it's a point lost on Rick Santorum that he gets up there and, oh, we're going to legislate all these morals for people. And on the other side, I heard in the State of the Union, Obama wants to set up government agencies for this, that, and the other thing. And I've got news for everyone. If that's the government, if that's the role of government to protect someone from their fellow man and what he might do to them, there isn't a form of government on the face of the earth that's going to work to do that. Have a great day.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I think he's speaking from a libertarian perspective, and there are libertarians within each party or libertarian strains within each party, particularly the Republican Party, that where you would find voters very much at odds with Rick Santorum, for example, on a whole series of issues. And we've seen in the Ron Paul candidacy, it's been kind of fascinating to watch in the Republican primaries, even though he's seemingly faded, in these early states where he was having an impact. I mean, to hear a Republican candidate get up and kind of articulate a foreign policy that sounded a lot more like Howard Dean in the Democratic primaries in 2004 than it did like any other Republican since then, and also on domestic issues, argue for civil liberties, argue for a different end to the so-called drug war, and take libertarian positions on those kinds of issues, you know, that creates a real debate in the Republican Party, although probably those positions are in a real minority in the Republican Party, as we've seen again from the Ron Paul candidacy. But in some cases, those issues are powerful among Republicans, and so you do have this sense in which some ideological lines kind of cross party lines. But I think one reason why things feel so divided today is that the ideological lines and the partisan lines have aligned more than they have in the past, and so that's why we see more divided.
Here's an email from Steve in Madison. Why is Barb Lawton not front and center in consideration as a Democratic candidate for governor?
You know, I don't know. I can't answer that. I don't know what Barb Lawton is up to these days.
All right. Let's go to Michael in New Berlin. Hello, Michael.
Well, my favorite president was probably Lincoln, but unfortunately, I wish I could speak more about the presidents. My concern is I did hear a caller discussing, and I've heard this off and on public radio, and I tend to be more toward the conservative side, but I still love Wisconsin public radio. My concern is that is a contraceptive issue, being a practicing Roman Catholic, are two things. First of all, we consider the birth control pill and some of them to be abortive because we believe that life begins at conception and the body's pills prevent implantation, which makes it abortive in our opinion and the church's opinion. And the second thing I want to mention is that people might say that 98% of Catholics, whatever the number is, choose to use birth control. The issue with that is it's not a democracy. It is a church. It's a faith. And we do a lot of things that the church considers wrong. It doesn't mean that it's a church's policy to be against contraception and birth control. And the third thing is that birth control can, in my experience, and I was in a bad marriage for many, many years with a person who could not get pregnant, and it can objectify a woman, turn her into an object rather than into a woman. Now that I'm in a relationship with a woman who can get pregnant, I see birth and sex in a totally different light. Those are the three things, you know, the main issues that I have to say.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there are a lot of angles to this debate, and so it isn't just a matter of whether you're for contraception or against contraception. I mean, there's the issues that we've already discussed about at what point you're setting healthcare policy, and at what point you're telling people, or you're telling the Catholic Church and its institutions, you know, what they should and shouldn't cover, and at what point it becomes a religious freedom issue. I mean, we've been talking a lot about Rick Santorum, and it's been kind of interesting on the campaign trail to hear him talk about this issue, because he is a very conservative Catholic who personally follows the Church's dictums on contraception, and additionally takes the position that when the Supreme Court ruled in, I believe it was Griswold versus Connecticut in the 1960s, the ruling out of which came the so-called right of privacy, and that was a contraception case involving, I think, a law in Connecticut that outlawed contraception but was not really enforced. Rick Santorum takes the position that that was wrongly decided, and that there is no constitutional right to privacy that would make contraception, for example, create a right to contraception. And his position is, therefore, that the states, as states, do have the legal authority to ban contraception, but that he would oppose that. So his position is that he opposes states banning contraception, but he believes that states actually constitutionally and legally can do that. And that's kind of a nuanced argument in its own way, but that probably is one that isn't necessarily a winner for him politically either.
We should spend a few moments talking about Mitt Romney, who has faded from view a little bit in the last month, perhaps. What does he need to do, Craig, to get everybody fired up about him?
Wow. If he can win the nomination, there's a process that just occurs around that does tend to rally people around their nominee. And even though it doesn't feel even though it's hard to imagine that happening now in some respects, if he were to go on and win the nomination, there would be a rallying around Mitt Romney, and most Republicans are so united in wanting to get rid of Barack Obama that they would coalesce at that point, and there would be some energy on that side. It's just hard to sort of, it's just getting from here to there. So what he has to do is just, he has to win the nomination, I think, to get people excited about him. And that's going to be a tougher, you know, that's going to be kind of trench warfare instead of a march to victory like it might have been if he'd won in South Carolina. So he has to go state by state and caucus by caucus and primary by primary and kind of outlast his opponents and collect more delegates and then try to dodge any brokered convention scenarios and win that war of attrition. And at that point, maybe pick a vice presidential nominee who is exciting, a little more exciting to the base, yet is not going to be damaging in a general election. And if all those things happen, you know, he could be a competitive general election candidate.
Craig Gilbert, our guest for All Things Political, this President's Day, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and there is a line open right now if you've been trying to get through. You can also send an email, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nancy Pearl is joining us, hour two of the show. It's been a little while since she's been with us. She is an amazing woman. She's an amazing reader. She has read so many books, and she remembers them, and she can offer advice on books for you, for children, for adults. She's the author of the Bookless series, former director of the Seattle Public Library. She was the one who came up with the idea, if all people in one city read the same book, which is still going on in many cities. And she will be with us to give us book recommendations. And we'll ask for presidential recommendations because of the nature of this holiday. Craig Gilbert is here now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Tom in Mequon. Hi. Oh, my gosh. Tom, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Tom. Hi.
Well, my observation is that since the Supreme Court ruling that allows unlimited money, what you're seeing now is that the extremely wealthy have decided to do what they've always wanted to do, and that is to take out organized labor at any cost, which they've got the funds to do it. So it's critical for working people to support organized labor, whether you're unionized or not, because if you look down south, for instance, where there are no unions, the pay for every worker is lower than states that have union laws, and the working conditions are much worse for those states down south, for instance. And also, if you look at who gives money to which parties, the extremely wealthy and these conservative think tanks give millions to the Republicans, where the only groups that have that kind of funds at all are unions who give to the Democrats. So if the right is able to destroy unions, that also destroys their enemy, the Democrats. So they win on two counts, and it's going to be terrible for working people, as you can see how things are changing. And I think whether you're union or non-union, you should support labor, organized labor, to have any chance for a good future for working people.
Craig.
Well, it's true that a big reason why Democrats, why people in labor, people on the left, were so united and activated and bitter about the proposals that came out of the governor's office last year were that it wasn't just a public to them. It's, you know, there's the public policy debate about whether, you know, about the role of public sector unions, but there's also the raw political fact, obvious to both sides, which is that you take unions, particularly and including and maybe particularly public employee unions, out of the equation, and that's a major financial and organizational pillar of the Democratic Party, and it's clear that that's part of what's going on here. I mean, you just can't. It's hard to separate those two things. I mean, that's not an irrelevant fact. I mean, that helps explain why Republicans supported this and Democrats opposed it, and so. That's a big piece of this, and why it's been so hard fought and so contentious. And it's going to be interesting to see on a state and a regional basis around the country how this plays out. He talked about efforts in other states. Obviously, in Ohio, you had the referendum which failed, which was where the Ohio voters rejected something similar to what Scott Walker had proposed. They have referendum in Ohio. They don't have referendum in Wisconsin, that happened in Ohio, another kind of industrial Midwestern state. But you've got in Indiana, you had the governor implementing kind of, I think, a right-to-work policy.
Yes.
And the right-to-work issue, which is, which affects private sector unions as well as public sector unions, has been kicked around and is being pushed in some states. When I was down in South Carolina, I was struck when the governor there, Nikki Haley, and South Carolina is a right-to-work state, said very kind of matter-of-factly and almost in passing, she was talking to a bunch of reporters, and she said, with a smile on her face, "I hate unions." And you don't hear, even in Wisconsin, as bitter as that, as everything has gotten, you don't necessarily hear...
No, you don't.
Well, you don't necessarily... I mean, Scott Walker hasn't stood up there and said, "I hate unions." In fact, he attacks, quote, big government union bosses, but he does make this distinction between public sector unions and private sector unions, and he said, from early on that he wasn't seeking changes that would affect private sector unions. So if he stands by that, he presumably wouldn't support right-to-work legislation. But again, the rhetoric is different because Wisconsin is a state with much more of a labor tradition than a state like South Carolina. And now you've got debates within the Republican Party. You've got Mitt Romney attacking Rick Santorum for voting against right-to-work legislation in the Senate. And Rick Santorum saying, "Well, I would support it, but I didn't vote that way because in Pennsylvania I had a lot of unions, and so I voted my state." So these things are, taking on, interesting forms, even within the Republican Party and within the Republican presidential race. And we're going to see if there is a primary in Wisconsin, a meaningful primary. There will be a primary, but if the race is still going great guns on April 3rd when we have our primary, with our kind of open primary and all sorts of people being able to vote, it'll be interesting to see how the Republican candidates address these issues.
Thanks, Tom. Claude in Madison. Hi.
Hi, ma'am.
Hi, go right ahead.
Morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I wanted just to make a comment about politics in America these days. It's really unfortunate that this country, with all the blessings of nature and God, if you want, is getting divided by some kind of greed and I would say calculated astuces, and people are aware of everything that is going on. And to tell you the truth, I was a Republican when I came here first, and I became a citizen. My first vote was Republican. But I've been quickly advised to not vote any more Republicans, because it's just the greed that is just pulling these people around. They're talking about God, and you don't see any godly thinking in all the rhetorics.
Where did you come from, Claude?
I'm coming from Africa, and my country, my originated country is Burkina Faso.
Oh.
I became citizen in 2006,
mm-hmm.
And my very first vote was Republican.
Craig?
Well, you know, there's two ways to answer that question, and one is to kind of, you know, wring your hands and say, it is bad. And, you know, it's unfortunate, and there's a lot of things about the political process today that even if you love politics, really put you off. On the other hand, you know, we do have to keep this in perspective. And, you know, we're not, these aren't violent times domestically. There are a lot of things that people used to violently disagree about that they don't really disagree about or argue about anymore. The kinds of kind of routine civil strife that we had at other points in our history, certainly when we talked earlier about the progressive era, the turn of the century, it was rife, both labor violence and racial violence, and also in this as recently as the 60s, which was a kind of time of upheaval. So with a little historical perspective, you can say, hey, it's not that bad, but we don't know whether, looking ahead in the future, which direction this is going to take, and whether we'll remember this particular period as kind of a blip or a period of intense political division followed by a settling, or whether this is just sort of a doorway to a more divisive and, mm-hmm. and turbulent time, and we just don't know that.
Thanks, Claude, very much. Alan is next. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Your guest failed to mention Kathleen Vineout, who's a state senator, one of the 14 that left the state to allow the protests to go on. She is running for governor. She's been running for several weeks. And I think what's interesting about her campaign is that if she does win the election, it would be a real game changer in politics, because there's no way that the Democrats can beat the Republicans in terms of raising the amount of money. So the issue can't be who raises the most money. Kathleen Vineout's campaign is based on basically a grassroots, bottom-down campaign. The same energy that went into making the recall successful is what she's counting on, that the feet on the ground and people's conviction and passion for a candidate and for getting back to the progressive tradition in Wisconsin, that will more than counter the millions of dollars that are coming in from the other side, and can really be, since Wisconsin is in the national limelight, a victory by a candidate with that kind of a campaign can really be give hope for the rest of the country that politics can change.
Craig.
Yeah, she is a candidate, and that's one reason why, that's one reason why we know there's probably going to be a Democratic primary. But she would have to, you know, even a Democratic primary, I think she would have to find a way to really put herself on the map in a way that she isn't right now, create an identity for herself in one fashion or another. When you're a state legislator and you're really just not known outside your district and you're in one of 33 state Senate districts, that's a tall order. I mean, Russ Feingold did it in 1992 when he got elected in a three-way Senate, U.S. Senate primary, but it took an extraordinary set of circumstances and this kind of crazy shooting war between the other two candidates who unloaded on each other with a barrage of negative ads late in the primary campaign and created a backlash. Just kind of a freakish set of circumstances for Russ Feingold to get elected in that primary and then go on to serve in the Senate. I don't know what the scenario is for Kathleen Vinehout I'm not ruling anything out, but she has to find a way to really kind of put herself on the map for potential voters in a Democratic primary.
Craig, thank you so much. Always a great pleasure to have you on. Happy President's Day.
And I'm going to read that book about Garfield.
Good. You'll like it. Let me know what you think. I'm sure you will. Let's thank again Craig Gilbert, and let's thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and for on-air production. Craig is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for all of your calls.